While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On The Radio News Analysis right here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. I am your host, Nafa Happy Juju. And of course, today is Friday, the 17th of April, 2026. And as the week draws to a close, the national rhythm begins to shift once again from execution to reflection across Namibia, from Swakopmund to Rundu, Ochuarongo to Rudrets, Katimamulilo to Hobabas, Ocho to Okahanja, Karabab to Tsumeb. Businesses, schools, and public institutions are wrapping up the week's work while taking stock of progress made and the challenges encountered. Now, Friday is where the results come into focus and moments to measure outcomes against expectations. The plans and the priorities set earlier in the week are now clearer in their impact, and attention turns to what has been achieved, what still needs attention, and how lessons learned will shape the days ahead. Now, on today's program, we continue tackling the focus shaping Namibia's economic direction as we get into commitments whether commitments are beginning to take shape and what they do signal for Namibia's economic future. We'll also broaden the conversation to the national landscape, looking at policy implementation, institutional performance, and the role of innovation in a rapidly changing economy. Young Namibians remain central to this shift, increasingly influencing the future of work and enterprise. Now, as the week concludes, an important question remains: are we moving fast enough to keep pace with changes, or perhaps are we lagging behind? In addition, we turn to governance and accountability, including developments within key ministries, and evaluate how leadership decisions are translating into real outcomes for communities across the country. Now, strategies move from announcement to action. The focus sharpens on delivery and impact. And as always, we stay grounded in the everyday realities that do connect us all when national priorities meet lived experience, and where individual voices continue to shape the broader national conversation. Of course, over the next 1 hour and 30 minutes, do expect sharp analysis, meaningful engagement, and the insights that do matter. Whether you're closing out your work day or on the move, or perhaps picking up kids from school this time of the day, or easing into the weekend, this is your space. This right here on the Radio News Analysis on Eagle FM, not just reporting the news, but making sense of it all. Now let's get right into today's discussions. The Deputy Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform, Ruthie Masake, has urged young Namibians to take decisive action in shaping the country's future during a youth engagement session held at Otamanzi Constituency Hall. Now, the session held under the theme Empowering Youth for Sustainable Agriculture, Fisheries, Water Security and Land Reform brought together youth from across the constituency to engage in opportunities on challenges and their role in national development. Addressing the gathering, Masake emphasized Namibia's progress depends on the active participation, innovation, and commitment of young people, particularly in key sectors such as agriculture, fisheries, land reform, and water management. She called on youth to shift their mindset and recognize these sectors as practical and a rewarding career path with strong potential for entrepreneurship and job creation. She further stressed the importance of sustainable and climate-smart practices, urging young people to adopt modern approaches in crop production, livestock farming, fisheries management, and water conservation. In a country like Namibia, she noted, challenges such as climate change and water scarcity require innovative and responsible solutions driven by the younger generation. Land reform was highlighted as a critical pillar, with the Deputy Minister encouraging youth to take advantage of government programs that improve access to land and agriculture cultural support services. She underscored that land ownership must go hand in hand with productivity, skills development, and sustainable use. But before we get into the Deputy Minister's speech, let's take a listen to one of the youth who participated in the conversation and giving her contributions as to how or encouragement to Namibians, especially the young ones, the young Namibians, to partake in this sustainable food security.
To summarize a bit about the National Youth Council, as is the umbrella that we are working on and the institution that is busy with the young people, the National Youth Council of Namibia, NYC, is a government-established body that represents and empower the young people in Namibia. It serves and link between the government and the youth and ensure that the young people's voice are heard and included in national and development decisions. Through NYC, we have structure in all constituency. OMSAT, we have 12 constituency, and each structure and each constituency is represented by the youth forum. Through the National Youth Council, the youth are benefiting. Young people are benefiting in several important ways. It provides skill development and training through workshop and leadership program. It helps the young people prepare from employment and entrepreneurship. It also creates a successful opportunity such as funding, internship, and scholarship. The council also promotes the youth to participate in the presentation, giving young people a platform to raise their concern and contribution to a national policy. It also supports the youth project and community activity an initiative enabling development and grassroots level. In addition, it encourages networking and collaboration, bringing young together from different regions to share their ideas. As today we are here just to engage with the minister, let us share our idea. Let us not forget our everything that was challenging us. I just want to inform that don't forget anything. The minister is here with us. Let's make sure she go with a package. although we also have challenge, the challenge that we have include the limited of resources, funding, which can restrict reach our program, especially in rural area. Youth unemployment also is this one is a big challenge, and also remain a major dispute ongoing efforts. Another challenge is a limited of awareness. Some of young people are not fully informed about the opportunity available through the counselor. In some cases, there is also low participation or engagement from youth with the effect which affect the impact of the programs. We also appreciate the government. The young express their sincere appreciation to the government of Namibia for establishing and supporting the National Youth Council. Through its continued commitment, the government has a greater opportunity for young people to grow, develop skills, and activity participate in national building. This support has contributed empowering the youth, promoting leadership, and improving access to the resources and opportunity. The ongoing investment in youth development is a strong foundation for the country's future. In conclusion, and the National Youth Council play a crucial role in empowering the young people, sharing the national development, while challenges remain. Continue support and activity participation from both the government and the youth will ensure greater impact and successful. I thank you. In short, I just want to inform our fellow youth, let us work hard. Let us work together. And most of you, they don't like to be in agriculture. They just want office administration, these things. But agriculture is the major role. Let's have that heart of feeding our nation to avoid buying products from different countries. Let us...
Get more for less at Voerman Brock. Like a 2 kg bag of nice rice for just $32.99. 100-gram Nescafe Rick Coffee, now only $29.99. A 2-litre Coca-Cola for a sweet $21.99. And 2 kg Surf hand wash powder, now just $49.99. See more mid-month deals at voermanbrock.com. We care.
From different country, let us ensure that let us promise to our government that yes, we can able to do. We want to reduce that number of importing product from our country, and also I want to tell the fellow youth that let us not give up. Let us come to the offices and then ask question where you don't understand. I don't think, and I want to thank all the constituency offices we have. They don't have any problem. They always are willing to help the young people, and I want fellow young people in Omsati region, let us venture into agriculture. Let us save and avoid and have food security in our mighty region. I thank you.
And we had it from one of the youth from the National Youth Council, encouraging other youth to take their role and to take their part in actually contributing towards food security. Indeed, she makes a strong point there to say that a lot of the young Namibians, a lot of youth are not really into the business of agriculture, forgetting that there's a skill also of entrepreneurship and job creation as well, but are rather waiting for office administration type of work or just that in that type of line. But I've come to realize that most of the young people, or a lot of young people who take up initiative for job creation, entrepreneurship, business-wise, always tend to do really great in the long run. As much as in the beginning, it's a little bit difficult. It can be difficult, and challenges are the emerging. And of course, they have to navigate their way around those challenges. They eventually plant their feet and they are young pers. I start to look up to them and wish that they could also do how they are doing. But most times, I think the issue comes in as we're not willing to start and endure those challenges and the sacrifices. You also get some young people who start their businesses on their savings. They begin to save on however little they are getting, however little they are making, wherever they are making some money. they save up and then start eventually their businesses and it produces results. So I think the encouragement comes at the very right time, not just for Otamanzi youth, but for Namibian youth overall, not just youth as well, but adults as well, because you get those who are no longer youth, but they're doing an important role and they're doing really well in their in their businesses, and especially within their horticulture, gardening work or whatsoever within their fields that they are doing. And some of them are producing actually on a large scale. I've come quite across a number of young people who are doing quite well. Some are producing maize, some are producing wheat, some are producing. It's just different ideas. And I think the other issue also is that young great ideas come to our minds and we neglect them. Sometimes we overlook them. And tomorrow when you actually see another person who is executing exactly the same idea that you had, you feel a little bit like, why didn't I just get into it and actually pursue it? I could have been somewhere today. So I think it's time to really, get into the work and put to work all those things that, because at the end of the day, at this particular point in time, agriculture is the talk of the day. Of course, Namibia wants to be food. They want to reach food sustainability. We want to be able to have food security. At the end of the day, I think eyes of many people have opened to say, no, we can't continue to import even the basic stuff that we can produce here. We can't continue to import bananas, for instance, from South Africa. We can't continue to, you know, let's do our own. And then after this conversation, we'll now be talking about, let's now add value to this. I mean, we talk about Mazoe, which comes from Zimbabwe, a nice, beautiful, tasty juice, you know, that comes from Zimbabwe. And they, I believe they make it out of mangoes. It's different flavors, but a lot of people love Mazoe juice. I personally, Mazoe juice is one of my favorite. When we're talking about juice, you know, you dilute it and make your own juice, and it has a long shelf life. Imagine a Namibian person coming up with wonderful juice, you know, that we make and sell it. And before you know it, you hear somebody on radio, perhaps in Uganda, saying, I'm a big fan of Mahangu pasta, for instance. Something that is locally made by the Namibian people, for the Namibian people, and for those also outside the borders of Namibia. So really, when you're talking about food security, I think the conversation has really been ongoing, and it's about time that people, actually yesterday I met a young lady who did agriculture, is it also fisheries, a mixture of some of those, you know, it's those people who did some of those courses that, yes, at this point in time, you are the people that we want on board, you are the people that we want to tell us how to do this, how to do that. And for some people, it's not necessarily that they got the skills and the knowledge and the theory through books and schools. For some of them, it's a passion for them. They taught themselves, you know, they decided to try out certain things. Almost like as if when you're learning how to bake, you make so many mistakes and eventually you know how to put this. Okay, you say next time I'm going to do this. You make some losses, but at the end of the day, you make more gains than the losses that you have made. Nonetheless, on water scarcity, Deputy Minister Ruth Masake warned that Namibia remains one of the driest countries in sub-Saharan Africa, calling on young people to prioritize efficient water use, conservation practices, and investment in water-saving technologies. That's another really discussion we ought to have. Many a times we do have water, we have flooded areas, and we need to actually harvest this water so that we can be able to use it. And I don't think that's a duty that relies on the youth shoulders per se. Maybe to pitch their ideas to the ministries, to the line ministries, and then it gets to be put into practice. But yeah, it's something that really needs to be discussed, and it needs to be discussed very soon, because we can't talking about water scarcity when really we can harvest some of the water, and before you know it dries up, and again same circle repeats itself. Floods come, a drought comes and all that kind of stuff. Now, in the fishery sector, she encouraged exploration of opportunities in aquaculture, marine resource management, and value addition, noting that they have potential to contribute to economic growth. Now, she has pulled on a strong call to action. A strong call to action formed the core of her message, urging youth to take initiative rather than remain passive, to seek education, to seek training, and to seek mentorship. And for some people who are probably saying, I don't think I'm able to take on a 3-year course or a 4-year degree course at this time. Well, we are now in an era where there are even short courses that are very beneficial and can get you way far ahead. All you have to do sometimes is to ask the relevant questions to the relevant people so that you can well move ahead within your idea and progress. And at the end of the day, it brings you money as well. So she also talked about forming cooperatives and partnerships and actively contributing to national development efforts. Now, the sessions also provided a platform for the young people to voice their concerns, as we had of a young youth there from the National Youth Council, where key issues raised included limited access to funding and financial support. This is just some of the shortcomings that we're still dealing with. Lack of technical training and mentorship programs, barriers to land ownership and utilization. That's another issue. Difficulties in accessing formal markets. But I think when there are partnership and real mentors who are in the field, who are able to give advice on certain matters, perhaps some of those barriers or challenges, they can be a way out. So participants described the engagement as both informative and motivating, welcoming the opportunity to interact directly with government leadership and contribute to discussions that affect their future. And it's initiatives such as this which are really worth of applause, because when leaders come down to grassroots level and hear the young people, their ideas, their shortcomings, their challenges, they feel heard, and they somewhat also then it encourages them to do more. I've heard in one of the trainings recently, where a lady was saying it was because of a certain minister Indileni Daniel, who on something that they had ideas of, and she gave out some advice on how to do certain things. It might look sometimes as if people are not listening, but there are always those who pick something and decide, hey, you know what, let me run with it, and it yields results for them. So sometimes really leaders coming up to grassroots level and addressing the people within the community, the young people, the community leaders themselves, it really boosts up. Because at the end of the day, when young people come and say, okay, I'm going to ask my parents on this part of our communal land to give me a certain portion so that I can grow some cabbage, some mahangu, not necessarily some mahangu, especially way in rural areas where mahangu is a staple crop, and it takes up most, perhaps 90%, if not 90% of the field. Now they come in to say, let me grow some tomatoes, let me add something, let's add some spinach, let's do some butternut, it takes some time sometimes for parents to really understand what the young people are saying. But I think it also boils down to say, when leaders come to communities and those elders are listening and they are hearing what is out there, what is in demand, because remember, they are not necessarily able to listen to certain conversation, they're not able to be in the city and attend certain workshops. But when they do hear community leaders and the leaders themselves from government coming to address them, they are then encouraged and to pursue their children. In fact, sometimes they are the ones that give the ideas to say, why don't you take a certain portion of the land and be able to grow some butternuts? I mean, we've seen horticulturists, people who are into horticulture, Doing very well. A very perfect example I like to make is of, what's this author? Otto Kapuka. He is an author. And of course, he is also into horticulture, and it's yielding results. You see him advertising, his produce for people to buy. So there is rewards in this. And not only that, he's providing employment to people within his community, which is a very good thing. And I think it's very fulfilling when you are doing something that is not only beneficial for you, but also beneficial for the next person or beneficial for the next people. So I think those conversations like this are not as much as maybe not exhausted enough. And perhaps, as they are being brought on the table and the workshops that are brought in, it's always very necessary to attend as young people so we can contribute to food security. And I still go back to what, the lady, the youth that just spoke about to say, we can't keep importing from outside. At this point now where we need to talk about, ourselves, sustainable, reproducing for ourselves. And then maybe in the few years to come, we can really start talking intensively about we're producing enough, this food security at home. Let's now talk about exporting. And yes, that's where also, as much as discussions for value addition are coming in also, I think that that one is on items that are on produces that are already happening, but on produces which need to be to begin, we have to really have this conversation. Now, the Tamanzi Youth Engagement forms part of broader efforts to align youth empowerment with national priorities such as food security, employment creation, and sustainable resource management. It also reflects a growing recognition that young people are central to building a resilient and self-sufficient Namibia. It is the young people that we are looking onto now, me being among those young people. Now, of course, so let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back, and when we do return, we'll be hearing now from the deputy minister, that is Ruth Masake herself, on her encouraging words to the young people in the agricultural sector. Nonetheless, we pause here. Please stay tuned.
Phew, what a day. Finally on my way home. And hey, the taxi's empty. So much room. Oh, no. Why is this big guy getting in and sitting on top of me? No, not the mimo with the big bag too. Now I'm squeezed.
Sometimes in life, you just get squeezed. But luckily with Express Credit's term loans, you can get up to 32,000 Namibian dollars to help ease your financial squeeze in under 15 minutes.
Ah, now that's a relief.
Visit expresscredit.com.na. Express Credit, money when you need it.
Welcome back. And now at this juncture, let's take a listen to Deputy Minister, that is Ruth Masake, on her encouraging words to the Namibian people and in playing their part. That is the Deputy Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform.
It is both a privilege and a pleasure for Masake Ruth to be in Otamazi constituents today. We are joining the youth of Omsati region under our powerful shared theme, Empowering Youth for Sustainable Agriculture, Fishery, Water Security, and Land Reform. The theme that I loved when I saw it upon invited. We stand here at a very important moment. The year 2026 must be defined by implementation, investment, and measurable results. Since January this year, I have engaged the youth people in Zambezi, Oshkoto, and Kavango West regions. Today, we bring this journey to Omsati, and I'm truly energized by the spirit and purpose I see in this hall. At the very stop, one message has been consistent, and that is our youth are ready. They are ready to work and ready to lead. What are these needs therefore demonstrates. It demonstrates a clear pathway, meaningful resources, and there are governments that are listening and ready to deliver. Omsati, today is your day. I would want you to embrace this day. Let me be direct about government's position. Youth must not be spectators. Youth must not be passive recipients of assistance. Youth must be partners. Youth must be producers. And youth must be leaders for Namibia's economic transformation. Under the NDP 6, agriculture, fishery, water, and land reform are identified as a priority productive sector for employment creation, for security, for food security, and for export growth. Especially for young people, NDP 6 calls on us to shift decisively from sustainable to commercial climate smart production. We need to champion youth-led agribusiness and agro-processing and value addition. We build robust value chain from soil and water to market and exports. To ensure land reform delivers unique, productive income and generation wealthy. This vision is therefore reinforced by the Swapo Party Manifesto Implementation Plan. With its commitments to the government of the Republic of Namibia to extend the youth access to land and water, affordable finance, and practical skills. To strengthen youth cooperatives and enterprises, to accelerate rural development through value chain and market leakages. To make our youth more economic and lasting. In short, we are working to make agriculture and fishery attractive, profitable, modern, and featured proof of the young Namibian ones, mainly for Oshkoto and Omsati and the rest of Namibia. Young people from Omsati, let me speak directly to your region. See extraordinary potential. Omsati is one of the most populated region in the entire Namibia, with a population exceeding plus minus 200,000 of beautiful and handsome Namibians. With well over 6% of the population under the age of 35, Omsati has what many regions lack: people, labor, and demand, and local market at the scale. But the comparative advantages of Omsati go far beyond the population. Omsati sits within the Kwilane Etosha Basin, one of the most significant water catchment systems in the northern Namibia, the Oceanus, the seasonal floodplain that defines the region's landscape. One of the simple natural features, they are economic asset waiting to be fully activated by Omsati youth. The Oceana creates condition and potential for seasonal and irrigated crop production in the flood reception zones. Aquaculture and small-scale fish farming using natural resources, water bodies. Fodder and pasture development to support livestock year around. Government continue to invest in water infrastructure, including the pipeline, S-dams, and borehole in this region. Youth must therefore position themselves around these water infrastructures to build productive, efficient water use enterprises. Agriculture is already underpinning more than 70% of the household in Omsati. I've seen when I was coming here, the field that are covered by mahangu, sorghum, legumes, livestock, and poultry are the backbone of the rural livelihood that I've witnessed today as I was coming. Yet, much of this production remains sustainability or subsistence-based, meaning local produced. And that is precisely where opportunity lies for the young ones. Government wants to see young one of Omsati leading in improved mahangu legume production using certified seed and conservation agriculture brackets. Poultry and the small stock production supplying schools and clinics, hospital and urban centers. Horticulture and vegetable production are under irrigation near S-dam and water points. Agro-processing, including milling, packaging, and shortage storage of reduced post-harvest losses. The livestock improvement and value addition through organized marketing, Omsati seasonal water bodies, offers a largely untapped opportunity in inland fishery and agriculture. These oceaners and S-dam can support that opportunity to scale up the small-scale fish farming and aquaculture appropriate water bodies, harvesting value addition of indigenous fish species, organize fish supply to local and regional markets. Government is extending aquaculture initiative beyond the coast and Omsati youth who are organized early will be able to move very fast and grab this opportunity that is lying in front of you. The land reform in Omsati must transform and translate into income. Not just allocation of land, but translated into income. Government continue to allocate agricultural land and provide post-settlement support. You, the use of Omsati, you have to receive these or to access land so that we are able to develop bankable business plan linked to productive enterprises, form cooperative to pool resources and access to economic upscale. Link land use to market demand, whether local, regional, or across the board. The promise of Omsati to Angola via various border points its market advantage. That organized, quality assured youth producers can and may exploit this market. To the question burning in every young person's mind today, what support exists and how do we access it? Let me answer it directly today. The National Youth Development Fund is a transformative financial instrument currently available in Namibia's youth, which was then launched in September 2025 last year and put on the table 257 million allocated for 2025-2026 is part of the total of 500 million capitalization. This fund was to build specifically for you. Administrated through the Development Bank of Namibia, Agribank, and the Environmental Investment Fund, the NYDF targets Namibia's youth aged at 18 to 45 with registered businesses, cooperatives, or agricultural ventures. The fund offers collateral free loans at a low interest rate, to be specific, 2% to 4%. Funding from 60,000 to 200,000 for starter up. That is at 2%. Scaling up over 1 million for larger project. That will demand you the retain of 3% to 4%. Repayment form of 5 years with a grace period of about 12 months. The priority sector, including agriculture, agro-processing, poultry, horticulture, fodder production, irrigation enterprises, and climate resilient projects. Exactly. The area where we are today, in Omsat, the youth can strive. Applications are ongoing with no closing date. Youth are therefore encouraged to work with regional youth officers, extensioners officers, constituent officers to prepare a bankable proposal. A bankable proposal. It is of paramount importance. The DBN supports high impact development projects, including large scale agribusinesses and value chain infrastructure, processing facilities, storage and cold chain investment, export reality. Program Director, as we move into our interactive dialogue session, I want to clarify that the government does not have all the answers. Policy must be informed by the reality on the ground. I'm here to come and assess and get the reality of OMSAT. That is your reality. I urge the youth of OMSAT today to speak to me openly and frank about the challenges. Land access, water, market access, they are the key barrier. The skill gaps and finance. Propose practical, grounded solution that the government and the development partners can implement. Let's share the idea for improving program delivery and policy design. We need to commit to forming cooperatives, registering enterprises, and preparing fundable proposal. This is how we coordinate and create governance that truly saves you and saves the Republic of Namibia. Let me conclude with this change to the youth of Omsati. This year, 2026, must be a year that you move from waiting
in to unusual.
Working. From waiting to working. Allow me then to officially say that I have covered most of the critical points. Allow me then to officially say that I have covered most of the critical points. And then from access to action. From access to do what? To action. From potential to unstoppable productivity. The ocean are filled with water every season, but water that is not channeled, that is not harnessed, simply resents or evaporates. The same is the truth of opportunities. The land is here. The water is here. The people are here. The market are here. The financial instruments are available. Thus, essential on the use of Omsati region to lead, to organize, to be disciplined, and to become entrepreneurs. Agriculture, fishery, water, security, and land reform are tomorrow's engine of growth. Wealthy and food security and national pride. Omsati youth, your nation believes in you. Rise, organize, produce, and lead. I thank you.
I think very powerful, interesting words there from the Deputy Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform. And especially, yes, addressing the Omsati region. And I believe also all the four O regions, including, Kavango West and East. But nonetheless, let's pause here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
And now for some economic indicators before we get into news beyond the borders of Namibia. We're starting off with the US dollar against the Namibian dollar, and while in US dollar today is equal to 16.39 Namibian dollars, while one Australian dollar is equal to 11 Namibian dollars point 75 cents, 1 euro On the other hand, is equals to 19 Namibian dollars point 33 cents, and £1 sterling is equals to 22 Namibian dollars point 17 cents. One Australian dollar is equals to 11 Namibian dollars point 75 cents. I think I already read. Okay. And then we have one Botswana pula coming in at one Namibian dollar point 22 cents. And yeah. Let's still pause here and we'll be back shortly with news beyond the borders of Namibia. Or perhaps let's just get right into it now. A new bill against the unlawful occupation of buildings in South Africa is being discussed to... And the Department of Human Resettlements has defended the prevention of illegal eviction from unlawful occupation of land amendment bill, saying it will protect both landowners and occupants. Let's take a listen to that.
Department of Human Settlements says there has been an increase in the unlawful occupation of land across the country. It believes that in some cases, unsuspecting individuals are lured by syndicates who intentionally break the law. The Prevention of Illegal Eviction from and Unlawful Occupation of Land Amendment Bill seeks to criminalize those who incite illegal property invasion.
One is the introduction, as I said, of additional offense to include those who incite or organize illegal occupation, even where no money is exchanged, is to impose a fine of about 2 million or imprisonment not exceeding 2 years or both on a person or individuals who incite people to unlawfully occupy land.
Abandoned buildings have also not been spared from unlawful occupation. Landlords find it hard to evict the people, with some using the law and the courts as delaying tactics. The amendment bill seeks to enable municipalities to apply for urgent interdicts, even when they are not the owners of their property.
Or protecting municipalities here, because subsequently, regardless of who the land belongs to, once it is illegally invaded, they are compelled to provide services which are enshrined in our constitution.
The department has denied that the bill will work against those who are desperate for housing.
We are trying to make sure that we legislate both evictions. You can't just wake up willy-nilly and evict. But it also withdraws the right for you that you can wake up willy-nilly and evade. Invade what is not registered. Otherwise, it will be a lawlessness country.
The public has until June to give their comments on the gazetted bill. The department will have its first public engagement session in Ekurhuleni in May. Nere Hlakotsa, SABC News, Pretoria.
Now let's hear on discussions on Malema firearm case. And so also they weigh in on the legal implications of it.
Yes, Malema. He has been granted leave to appeal his 5-year jail sentence. However, this application to appeal his conviction has been, we're obviously looking at this conviction has been denied and Malema is now sentenced to direct imprisonment for firing a semi-automatic rifle at a rally in Datsani back in 2018. Magistrate Toinette Olofi then handed down the sentence at the Kugompos City Magistrate's Court yesterday. Addressing supporters outside the court, Malema launched an attack on the magistrate, accusing Olofi of racism. So we're going to look at the legal implications, and for that we're going to be joined by legal analyst Ntabi Singh Bazana, as well as senior research specialist for democracy and citizenship, Prof. Jolene Steyn-Kutsia. Good morning to the both of you, and thank you for joining us at this hour, because we're obviously looking at the appeals process now. That's taking center stage in the next phase of this case. And so, Tabi Singh, let me get your reaction, given the sentence that had been handed down. Was it something that you expected? But if we're looking at the boundaries that this case is testing, whether it's hate speech, whether it's incitement, perhaps also political expression at large, let's get your thoughts.
All right. So when it comes to the charges that he was facing and the kinds of sentences that we're looking at, the sentence that was handed down is both a surprise and not so in the same breath. Why do I say that? When we look at the arguments that were put forward by the defense team, which maybe I may be biased as a defense attorney, but to me they made sense. in the sense that they were making reference to different cases where a firearm was discharged, where in a possession of that said firearm was illegal, which is part of the charges that he was facing. And then in one case that the defense made reference to was where in a security guard, I believe, had shot and killed one individual and the other one got injured. And then with that, that person actually got a suspended sentence. And then another one was a discharge of a firearm in close quarters, in other words, in a restaurant, where it could have, where the projectile could have hit any individual, or it could have damaged somebody's hearing, any damaged property, etc. With even with that, the accused in that particular case was given a suspended sentence. So with that kind of plethora of case law that was provided to her, her response when she was handing down her sentence was to say, I cannot speak on cases that were not before me. I can only speak on his, the case that is before me, and I am saying that they have no bearing here, which doesn't make sense. Because in terms of one of those particular cases, an Eastern Cape High Court, which binds her to make a certain decision, and she did not follow what that kind of direction.
Because, I mean, the implications are far-reaching for the landscape, for the party itself. And so Prof could hear the political narratives emerging for Julius Malema, for the party itself, but even just the courts being used as political battlegrounds. What's unfolding on that front?
You know, it's quite interesting because we speak of courts almost as political battlegrounds when we should start looking around questions of, let's say, the principality as a rule of law, as a central democratic value, you know, to what extent there is trust in the court system, and how possibly a lack of political trust in our institutions, including the courts, then almost shape narratives around, well, the courts are being used as a battleground, for example, to achieve political goals.
Let's pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Back to that analysis on Malema's firearm case.
And I think that that is a very important conversation that we do need to have, to what extent democratic values around respecting the rule of law, respecting
the
due process translates not just from the institutions, but into broader society and from broader society into the institutions as well.
The legal tactics that are also at play speaks to some of the timelines from year two as well. And so, Ntabi Singh, if we're looking at this appeal process now, the timelines, how long it's likely to take, considering the backlog in South African courts as well. Tell us a little bit more about that, his position as an MP as well, but even bail or reporting conditions that apply in this scenario.
So after the application of bail was, of appeal was done, automatically they had to make an application for bail, because unlike in civil proceedings, where in once a judgment has been handed down, if you make an appeal in terms of Section 18, it suspends that particular judgment. So here, even though it technically suspends the judgment, you are still a sentenced individual. So immediately after, you ought to have got straight into the cells in order for you to be transported to prison. So that's why they immediately had to make a request to the magistrate to say, now that you've granted us our appeal, albeit it's only on sentence, can the accused now continue in the trajectory he's always been in, that he was released on his own cognizance or out on warning? And then that was granted. Now going forward, the appeal process is that the attorneys are going to draft what we call a petition, and they're going to petition the High Court with regard to the appeal on conviction, because that was denied them. to them, sorry. So now they need to petition the High Court directly to say, irrespective of the court having said they're not going to grant us an appeal on conviction, can you still hear us anyway on the conviction and also the sentence that was granted to us? So the timelines are going to be interesting because high courts have serious backlog. If we look at our own high courts here in Gauteng, we are looking at 2029 when it comes to dates. It's insane. So we are hoping the Eastern Cape doesn't have such an insane backlog. And if they don't, we're looking anywhere between a year or 2 years for them to get a date and their matter to be heard.
It's certainly going to be interesting given those timelines. And even if we look at, you know, the long-term strategy for the EFF, I mean, Prof Kutsia, politicians using legal troubles perhaps to gain political capital. Tell us a little bit more about what's unfolding on that, particularly in an election year. Does this signal more support at the ballot box down the line?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, my crystal ball is somewhat broken. So, you know, but if we do look at around the politics and we do look at political narratives and political rhetoric, it is important to be mindful that politicians have always been quite antagonistic in their political rhetoric with each other. And of course, with regards to institutions, if things may not necessarily go in favor of our political leaders, then we also find an antagonism towards institutions and almost an attack on those institutions. We have seen it before if we reflect on political violence that had occurred in 2021. If we look at this build up towards, you know, we have local government elections 2026 and of course 2029, if I'm not mistaken, would be another election year as well. Yes. And here, political parties, especially the EFF, I would argue, will need to be mindful of how political rhetoric can almost inflame, if you will, actions or embolden action. And we need to be mindful that we have democratic processes and institutions through which those actions should be taken.
Because there are also risks involved given this legal process as well. And so in Tabi Singh, if we're looking at the legal grounds in this case, I mean, challenging the conviction, challenging the sentencing, is it both? Because if it does not go to the High Court, I mean, what are the risks involved when it comes to the sentence, leniency, some of the other factors? How bad could it get? Could it eventually even get to the Constitutional Court?
It likely can get all the way up there. And, you know, there's always a 50-50 gamble on which way another court would hear the matter. And the thing is that we don't start from scratch in a new court. We are literally taking the transcript of the court a quo and then looking at it and reading it or listening to it and then trying to assess if we can come to a different conclusion versus the original person presiding officer hearing this. So you're not given an opportunity to highlight certain things that you could have missed in the original trial. So with all of that, there's always a likelihood that if you are heard, which you're going to be heard because appeal at least was granted in sentence, it could go either one, you are going to be, the status quo will remain as is. Number two, it can be that it's remitted back to the trial court for them to give a higher sentence because it was not correct. Alternatively, the court grants a higher sentence. Or number three, they are saying, no, we disagree with the court completely. You shouldn't have been given this kind of sentence. We're not even sending it back to her. We are giving you this kind of sentence. You know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, a discharge of a firearm had happened. A possession of a firearm did happen. But there are certain circumstances that surrounded that that I am of the opinion the court did not look at when they did the conviction.
Because this, I mean, we're obviously looking at accessibility and Julius Malema, you know, serving on the JSC, perhaps also as an MP. If we're looking at politics entering the judiciary and judicial neutrality as well. I mean, Prof Kutsia, tell us a little bit more about the different arms and the concerns on that front that's coming forward in this case as well then.
Well, I think, you know, just oversight roles, of course, that MPs and Parliament plays over our institutions. We have, for example, commissions of inquiry, or when we have various parliamentary committees that sit and ask various institutions to account for what had happened, or how they had spent their budgets, or, you know, rationale for taking decisions that they have. I think for me, the very interesting thing or underlying dynamic that one will need to look at as this case unfolds would be to what extent there would be respect for the institutions around the decisions, even though one may not necessarily agree with those decisions. So, you know, we may very well find that a high court has a different opinion than the sentence and the conviction that was handed down. Would there be respect for that decision at the end of the day? And I think that is the very crux of the matter when we speak of oversight, separation of power, different arms of government, is that institutions still remain central to how processes unfold and due processes unfold.
And I mean, we're also looking at the political terrain. Does it open up space for alternative voices, but even, you know, reinforcing identity politics, particularly when it comes to issues of land and race, class, etc., historical grievances? How would you weigh in just rather quickly as we wrap up?
No, definitely. And I think this is where I have done some work and research before around the centrality of political intolerance within our political narratives, our political rhetoric, not just from the EFF, other parties as well. And there, I think the key message is politicians need to be careful that reckless statements cannot necessarily be made under the umbrella of being radical or seeking radical change.
All right.
I like that last point that you made, that politicians need to be careful that reckless statements cannot be made under umbrellas of radical change. And I myself don't agree with Julius Malema's kill the Boers, kill the whites. That's not radical. That is pathetic, because at the end of the day, if you want to be a leader and a ruler, you have to rule over people of different race and color, different tribes. And if you're not ready to rule over all of them, then I think you shouldn't be a leader at all. But that's my opinion. Nonetheless, let's move forward and talk about news in Rwanda, where drones boost pig farming yields.
Cutting across Rwanda's hills from south headed to the north, these drones are on a different mission, not medicine this time, but something just as vital for farmers: swine semen. A small delivery, yet a big transformation for pig farming across the country. In Gicumbi district, northern Rwanda, Jean Claude is among the early adopters. He has spent 17 years in pig farming and is now one of just 7 certified breeders in the country. Before drones, accessing quality breeding services was slow, costly, and often unreliable.
Before Zipline came in to support in semen delivery, it was difficult for farmers to get semen in real time. But now my pigs conceive more easily. I get more piglets and better income. It has really changed how we farm.
Today, once a pig is ready, farmers can receive high-quality semen within minutes, allowing for timely artificial insemination. The results: healthier pigs, improved genetics, and higher productivity.
Officials at Rwanda Agriculture and Animal Resources Development Board say that drone delivery of swine semen has transformed pig farming across the country. They report that success rate of insemination has risen by nearly 30%, boosting pork production and improving veterinary services across the country, especially for farmers in remote areas.
Hirwa Claire, animal breeding senior researcher at RAB, says the impact of drones is significant.
Before using the drones, the success rate was around 55%, but for now it's around 75%, between 75 and 8%. It means the drone helps us to send the semen as fast as possible then the farmers, they will be able to get the semen on time. Then they will be able to inseminate their pigs.
The system, introduced at scale in 2021, has rapidly expanded. From just 500 doses delivered in early stages, Rwanda now distributes around 20,000 doses every month. The technology is powered by Zipline, originally known for delivering blood and medical supplies. Today, it is also supporting agriculture.
So today, 27% of deliveries in a day are mainly directed to redistribution of pig semen across the country. It started by resolving an actual challenge in pig insemination. So you had to find, as a farmer, you had to find through your vets a bull nearby in real time when your pigs are in heat period, which is unlikely.
For farmers like Jean-Claude, the benefits go beyond numbers. With faster delivery, lower costs and better outcomes, pig farming is becoming more predictable and more profitable. With drones delivering critical inputs like swine semen, Rwanda is not only improving productivity, but redefining the future of farming. Ethan Tshabia for CGTN, Kigali, Rwanda.
You know, DRC Congo raises $1.25 billion in its first international bond sale.
Foreign investors have shown strong demand for Eurobonds issued by the DRC government earlier this year. The country's first ever issuance of a debt instrument has raised $1.25 billion. The Eurobond, issued under the supervision of the International Monetary Fund, is meant to strengthen the country's capacity to fund energy and infrastructure projects.
Gaining access to the international market is a very important stage for our country. That's why we're celebrating this historic achievement. First of all, it highlights our country's solid macroeconomic perspective. That's why I keep telling investors not to listen to what the media says. Judge us by our macroeconomic performance. We are the DRC, the world's largest cobalt exporter. In 2024, we exported 220,000 tons of cobalt. And today, cobalt sells for more than $56,000 per ton.
The sale of the bonds comes at a time when the DRC's economy has been battered by more than 4 years of conflict in the east of the country. The government has spent millions of dollars meant for development projects on the war effort. Finance experts have applauded the government for issuing the bond, but called for strict financial discipline.
I think international borrowing for us should not be a problem. The main thing, as I said, is efficiency at use. How do we allocate this money and how do we use it and how does it give a return on investment to the next generations?
The DRC relies heavily on revenue from its mining sector, but the country has grappled with corruption for decades. The implementation of economic reforms called for by the World Bank and the IMF has improved transparency. The country recently benefited from a positive credit rating by global agency S&P, which said the DRC's gross domestic product was set to average 5% until 2028. Experts say bond sales across developing countries soared at the beginning of this year, but later ground to a halt after the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran began. Fears of rising energy prices and inflation led to higher borrowing costs.
The Democratic Republic of Congo's entry into the Eurobond market has included it among a growing list of African countries that borrow directly from institutional investors. Authorities here say the move illustrates the renewed confidence that investors have placed in the country's economy despite years of conflict in the East. Chris Ochamringa, CGTN, Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of Congo.
Meanwhile, Africa's economic power shifts as new growth hubs emerge.
After nearly 27 years in business, Abuja-based shoemaker Chidebere Eze has been adjusting to rising costs and a volatile currency. For Chidebere, staying profitable is becoming harder, forcing tough decisions just to remain in business.
Material is cost, number one. Number two, where we are working, NEPA no do not give us light like that. That's number two. But material is number one. Material is too cost for markets now. Some people, if they came to my shop, they came to my shop to buy work. So the way I did sell my material before, my work before, now things have increased because of material have increased. So I have to increase.
Chidebere's experience reflects the pressures facing Africa's largest economy at a time when growth is accelerating in other parts of the continent. For decades, Nigeria, South Africa, and Egypt have dominated Africa's economic landscape, but that long-standing balance is now beginning to change. New data from the International Monetary Fund shows a structural shift underway. A group of fast-growing economies, including Kenya, Ethiopia, Ghana, and Cote d'Ivoire, are expanding rapidly, with several crossing the $100 billion GDP mark.
If you look at these countries, they have invested significantly in infrastructure. Also, in terms of fiscal policy, they are among countries that have achieved high fiscal discipline, which in a way is restraining, you know, the accumulation of debt. Some of the investment that actually drive this growth are heavy investment. They are not portfolio investments.
That growth is also being driven by changes in the type of industries powering these economies.
In Africa today, the sectors that are growing very well is the fintech, the agriculture, the value chains in agriculture, if you compare to, you know, initially when we used to have the oil sector, you know, that, you know, taking the largest chunk of the growth.
Africa's total GDP is projected to reach about $3.3 trillion by 2026, highlighting both expansion and a more distributed pattern of growth. For Nigeria, the shift raises critical questions about its role in a changing economic landscape.
Nigeria is living in its past glory. We must tell ourselves that truth. Insurrections, bad policies, bad governance, lack of infrastructure, lack of human capital, lack of foreign investments, political interference. A lot of these are just simply making us very uncompetitive and unproductive. What we need is a commitment to making certain that we secure our country.
While Nigeria remains one of Africa's largest economies, analysts say maintaining that position will depend on how quickly it can address its internal challenges and adapt to a more competitive continental landscape. As more economies rise, Africa's growth is becoming less concentrated and more competitive. A shift that could redefine economic leadership across the continent. Kelechi Amekalam, CGTN Abuja, Nigeria.
Meanwhile, experts warn the global financial risk could deepen Africa's debt pressures.
I'm joined by Dr. Yonggong Zhong. He's an interim executive director at the African Forum and Network on Debt and Management. Doctor, great to have you on the show with us today. Now, of course, as we heard there, the IMF's warnings about global financial risks, which are ahead, they include rising borrowing costs for African nations that we know are just only now recovering from the post-pandemic shock. Now, for countries that are already carrying heavy debt burdens, is another debt crisis inevitable if we do see another round of economic shocks ahead in light of this war?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. And thank you for this very important question on the current situation with Africa's debt crisis and whether another debt crisis is inevitable for Africa. Of course, this is not inevitable, but also highly probable that Africa will be facing, that the current debt crisis will actually escalate, because Africa, you know, is already in a heightened debt distress with about 20 African countries either in debt distress or in high risk of debt distress, according to IMF and World Bank estimates. And this signals systemic vulnerabilities that would aggravate with the current crisis caused by the ongoing war in the Middle East. Debt levels rose sharply from the COVID-19 period, and this has also been aggravated by the high cost of borrowing for African countries. And just in about 3 years, you know, the bond yields actually to African countries grew by about 5%, you know, rising from about 7% to about between 10 to 16%, you know, between 2019 and 2022. And this conditions actually continue to actually tighten, and many countries are effectively priced out of international capital markets. And this doubles down on the fact that debt is already crowding out developed, and many countries now spend more on debt service than on health and education. So it is most probable that Africa, you know, the current debt crisis is actually going to aggravate.
Right. And I'd like to get into what you mean when you say aggravate, because as you said, the war could certainly test the resilience of financial systems going forward. We could see funding markets tightening going forward, bond market volatility as well. But as the conflict drags on longer than we previously expected, how far is Africa now from just funding strains to now full-on financial instability, the likes that we saw during the 2008 financial crisis?
In fact, we are already in a pre-instability condition, with tightening global liquidity and reduced capital flows, there are currency depreciations across multiple countries, there's limited access to refinancing for maturing debts, and there are significant risks as well in terms of African countries facing tens of billions of Eurobond repayments between 2024 and 2030. And many of them are also relying on very costly domestic borrowing, as well as bond markets that are also highly volatile. You know, it's becoming very, very invisible. So we will all can already say that Africa is already very close to that instability with all these pre-instability conditions that I've highlighted.
Now, what was interesting was at these ongoing spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank, we saw policymakers launch what they called the borrowers platform. And I think that was led by the UN, UNCTAD, I think. They said this platform will fill a gap in the international financial architecture, basically providing a borrower-led space to share knowledge and also amplify their collective voice. I wonder what that means. Now, what's your take on this new platform and how necessary and effective it will be in addressing the very real debt challenges that Africa faces?
Yes, this platform is necessary, because for a long time, there has not been coordination among the borrowers. When you look at the creditors, you see that they are more coordinated, and that is why they dominate the system. Creditors within, for instance, the Paris Club, the credit rating agencies, you know, they are more coordinated. So the borrower club, borrower's platform, as you may call it, you know, becomes necessary at this time for borrowers to also coordinate themselves and have the potential of also influencing the international debt architecture in terms of the terms and conditionalities of accessing finance. Because for a long time, this has been creditor dominated, especially by the Paris Club members. We have also seen private creditors coming into the picture, and credit rating agencies who also determine how much countries can access finance. You know, all of this, you know, signals one thing, that the creditors need to be coordinated. But this coordination should actually provide solutions if it addresses the structural constraints that African countries are faced within the global financial architecture, rather than addressing more of symptoms or micro-level vulnerabilities, you know, to the global financial system. For instance, we keep asking and actually as one of our main advocacy points is to have, you know, a United Nations-led process where countries have equal voice in terms of influencing the global financial architecture, determining the rules governing how countries can access finance. So the borrower club becomes, or platform becomes, a very important initiative at this time. And again, it will become even more important if the borrower's platform is able to push for structural changes within the global financial system rather than also just addressing micro-level issues, as I already highlighted.
Usually forceful political remarks, Pope Leo has said the world is being ravaged by a handful of tyrants. Addressing a crowd during his visit to a region of Cameroon ravaged by a separatist insurgency, the head of the Roman Catholic Church condemned the people who he said had manipulated the very name of God for their own gain. The extraordinary comments come amid a spat President Trump has had with the Pope, President Trump calling Pope Leo weak on crime. Let's have a listen to the Pope.
The masters of war pretend not to know that it takes only a moment to destroy. Yet often, a lifetime is often not enough to rebuild. They turn a blind eye to the fact that billions of dollars are spent on killing, on devastation. Yet the resources needed for healing, education, and restoration are nowhere to be found. The world is being ravaged by a handful of tyrants. It is held together by a multitude of supportive brothers and sisters.
Let's bring in our global religion reporter, Lebo Diseco. These are, as I said, unusually forceful comments from a pope, and in the context of some quite forceful stuff coming the other way from Washington.
Yeah, and they have just been, or Pope Leo has just been backed up, as it were, by the Archbishop of Canterbury, leader of the third biggest Christian denomination of the world, Sarah Mullally, who said, "I stand with my brother in Christ, His Holiness, Pope Leo the 14th, in his courage to call for a kingdom of peace." Now, the context of this, you did kind of explain this earlier in your introduction. He was speaking in the capital of the Northwest part of Cameroon, where there has been an insurgency for about 10 years, which has killed thousands and thousands of people. So he was addressing a service there, a crowd of people there. And you could say that, you know, some of the things he said related to that. But it comes after a week of, you know, back and forth with the Trump administration and Donald Trump himself. We saw at the start of the week lashing out at Pope Leo in an extraordinary fashion. Pope Leo has been very critical of war in general and spoken out quite vociferously about the war, the conflicts that we see at the moment. He, in his Good Friday address, said that leaders that you know, kind of promote war or push war won't be blessed. And then we saw his Easter Sunday sermon used to call for peace again. So this is kind of a ratcheting up of the tensions. We also had J.D. Vance, the vice president of the United States, a recent convert to Catholicism, saying that Pope Leo should be careful when it comes to speaking about doctrine.
Yeah, careful about his theology.
Yeah.
Quite extraordinary advice for a politician to give the Pope. What was interesting about the juxtaposition of Pete Hegseth talking about the war in the last hour was that he was giving us this sermon, or recounting his sermon from church on Sunday, which he'd taken from the book of Mark, at the very time that the Pope was warning leaders should stop using religious language to justify their wars. And this is really the problem that a lot of Catholics in the United States have been pointing to, that they're invoking God to justify their actions.
Yeah, I think with Pete Hegseth, Pete Hegseth is actually not a Catholic. He's an evangelical Christian, or that's the church that he would, or the, I guess, denomination that he falls under. But I think there is a broader issue of the use of religious symbolism, religious language in talking about the war by the Trump administration, which for many Christians, Catholics, and, you know, Christians more widely, is really antithetical to the teachings of the Bible. So I think it being used in this way is quite difficult for a lot of Christians. My colleague Aline McBull has reported extensively on this yesterday, hearing from Catholics in America who are saying, look, this is just actually not done, and it's not okay.
And maybe the criticism, Lebo, stings a bit more for Donald Trump, because here is an American who actually, when you look at polling, is much higher in the approval ratings than he is and is widely respected.
Well, Donald Trump claimed earlier on in the week that he was responsible for Pope Leo's election as the head of the Catholic Church. I think a number of figures within the Catholic
I thought it was
hierarchy.
God who chose the Pope.
Well, I mean, I think they would say they were led by the movement of the Holy Spirit. So, I mean, Donald Trump has been a roundly kind of criticized for that statement. But I think it is difficult. I think you have to remember that Donald Trump had a lot of support from evangelical Christians, but also a lot of Catholics, white Catholics in particular, lean Republican. So this is a core part of his support base. Certainly, the Christian vote is important to him, and he doesn't seem to be, you know, endearing himself to them or to many parts of that voting bloc this week.
Lebo Di Secco, our global religion reporter, thank you very much. Certainly some huge crowds that are coming out for the Pope on his visit to Cameroon. There you can see some of the congregation. But it will be fascinating to watch some of the reaction in Washington to the comments we've had from Pope Leo today, which, although he didn't mention President Trump by name, certainly you can't miss the inference of what he was saying. You're watching BBC News.
Meanwhile, U.S. farmers feel the pinch as the war in Iran drags on.
Welcome back, everyone. The war between the U.S. and Iran has sent the cost of some goods soaring, and caught in the crosshairs are none other than U.S. farmers. From the fertilizer to plant their crops to the diesel that runs their tractors, farmers are feeling pinched from all sides. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze was in Virginia, where there's real concern about the long-term damage this war can inflict.
It's peak planting season at Coulon Farm in Bealeton, Virginia. Fourth-generation farmer Ben Smith and his father Ken are now applying fertilizer for their crops, including soybeans and corn.
You can underspray, but you can't overspray.
Farmers prepare for all sorts of contingencies, but not necessarily war.
We didn't see this one coming. We
But now, before we log out, let's actually call up our lucky winner for this Friday's gift voucher. Okay. Ringing. Let's see if they will pick up and be the lucky winner. And I always say, please stay on the line on this Friday and every Friday this time around, just in case you are the lucky winner. Let's go back to our news for now.
We weren't prepared.
The crops they're getting ready to plant will be used to feed their herd of dairy cows.
How much milk comes out of this farm every day?
About 10,000 gallons leave this farm a day.
10,000 gallons of milk every single day.
We watched as a fuel truck filled up the farm's diesel tank. It happens three times a week here during planting season. With his trucks and tractors all running on diesel, Ben says they're going through about 3,000 gallons a week.
We were paying roughly $3.50. Now we're at about $5.50, so it's increased $2 a gallon.
$2 just in 6 weeks.
That's about right.
It's a pretty big increase in a short amount of time.
A pretty steep increase in a very short amount of time. They left me scrambling trying to find some additional storage tanks so that I could try to buy up as much as I could now before it continues to track up.
According to Gas Buddy, diesel prices are up nearly 50% since the start of the Iran war. Ben says he's paying an extra $80,000 in fuel this spring compared to last year, plus $35,000 more in fertilizer.
So you're talking more than $100,000 in extra costs.
That's
because
exactly
of
right.
What we're seeing with the supply chain and the...
A very good afternoon, and you are live on Eagle FM. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, and how are you?
I'm all good, thank you. Who am I speaking to?
Rusa Mungongoro.
Rusa Mungongoro.
Mungongoro.
Mungongoro. Rusa, this is Happy Juju calling you from Eagle FM. You're live on radio now. I'm calling to inform you that you are this Friday's lucky winner of the 500 ShopRite You Saved gift voucher.
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. Congratulations, Rosa.
So I'm so much excited.
Yeah. I mean, it's in the middle of the month, you know. you can go buy yourself those things, that those items in the house that are starting to go finishing and missing now.
Sure. Like for now, ne?
Mm-hmm.
I was just even don't have a cooking oil. I was just thinking that home is going to give me even a $25 to go and just buy a cooking oil in Metro.
Imagine. Now you can go buy yourself the whole 3-liter one, so that can last you for the next 2 months, depending on your household. But congratulations.
Yay.
And you can top up with some, and buy yourself some chocolate as well. Yeah?
Yeah.
Congratulations, Rosa. Where are you? Where within Namibia are you?
I'm in Ndangwa.
Okay. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay. You know what? My team will call you up and let you know how you can pick up your gift voucher. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.
Okay, and that's our Friday's lucky winner of the 500 ShopRite You Save gift voucher. Now remember, this competition is ongoing for a very long time, so you could be the lucky winner. Please do reply to those messages and answer it correctly. And you never know, you can just be the one that walks away with the gift voucher next Friday. Now from Indafa Happy Juju, at this point I say goodbye. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengue program coming your way now with Aloise Shimi. And also don't forget to tune into our podcast that is on weekend shows. We bring you insightful conversations. Goodbye.